Session number 995.
Sir John Baker Carr, Reel 1. Sir John, you were 8 years old when the First World War broke out, and so you spent the war years at prep school.
That's
what
right.
What kind of impact did the war have on you at that age?
I think that the first impact, of course, was the headlines of the newspapers, something like Liège falls or something of that kind, and one felt that something horrible was going on, but of course it was extremely remote. One had had no previous experience of war when one was very young. Then the air war began to come into one's consciousness, and with the Zeppelins and the daylight raids on London, which one I remember, I think in about 1916 at 10:30 in the morning. Then, of course, the great heroes of the Royal Flying Corps, McCudden, Ball, Pat Mannock. And from time to time, I would manage to see some flying going on at Hendon, and I remember one particular occasion when I was in the country, an aircraft, some sort of fighter, actually landed in a field. Whether he'd come to see his girlfriend or not, he managed to get off, so I'd assume it wasn't a forced landing. This looked like almost like a man from outer space to a boy of 8 or 9 years old. Very thrilling indeed. And my interest in flying was then became concentrated on model aircraft, and I had every sort bought mostly from Gamages, but also, strangely enough, from a German toy shop in Kensington High Street where I lived, a place called Lorberg's, and I bitterly regretted when poor old Lorberg had to close down because he was a German.
Your father wrote a vivid account after the war of his own involvement with machine guns and tanks during the war. Did you see very much of your father actually during the war?
Well, no, I didn't see very much of him. And I can't say that I was interested in machine guns. Tanks, yes, because they were very much at the end of the war. And there again, they had an extraordinary novelty, like the aeroplane. And although, in fact, I don't think they really made a great deal of difference to the war, they were given an enormous amount of publicity, and since my father had something to do with them, I took an interest in them. And that's about all. But none of these things, I don't think, made me think of soldiering or going into flying as a profession at all. It seemed to be all part of something that was going on rather remotely in the world that would eventually disappear, and one would get on with one's hobbies and sports and perhaps get a bicycle or something of that kind.
Did your father encourage you at all in the idea of going into the services?
No, rather the reverse. By the time I had left prep school and went to Harrow for a short time, and he came out of the army, my impression was that he was keen to get out and make his fortune in some sort of civilian pursuit, which was, in fact, going out on a government settlement scheme to what was then British East Africa, and taking a vast amount of land out there and a timber concession.
In 1919, you actually went to Harrow for a short time. What were your strong points at school? Was it academic or sport?
No, you see, I was awfully young. One went to public school in those days, and I actually went less than 13 years old. So that really my main concern was being a fag, I should think, running round making the fires for my seniors or something of that kind. I'm afraid I had few ideas of my own, only really to dodge authority as far as possible.
As you were saying then, your career at Harrow was soon cut rather short by a fairly dramatic family move.
Yes, well, my father had decided to make his life out in East Africa, and my elder brother and I were at Harrow, and he said, would we like to come out to East Africa with a tutor? And, of course, being boys, we said, my goodness, we certainly would. But I look back now with great regret at this family decision, because I went out to East Africa. The tutor taught us practically nothing at all, and we all jumped on horses and chased zebra and hartebeest, and we really didn't learn anything at all. And unfortunately, I got malaria and blackwater and eventually had to leave the country and go to America, where I had relations, because my mother was American, who would have the burden of taking care of me for a while.
Did you find, were conditions very primitive on your farm in East?
Oh, very primitive indeed. And the house hadn't been built and we lived in tents. But it was a marvellous climate, and of course a beautiful country, and completely unspoiled by all the apparatus of civilization. Indeed, the local tribe, the Wagishu, when my father arrived there, I don't think he'd seen a white man, and they were still cannibals to the extent they never wasted any human flesh. They didn't kill it to eat, but they wouldn't waste it if it came their way.
Did you have very much contact with the natives?
Oh, very much so. We had 800 of them working on the farm, and they lived in a cantonment fairly near our tents.
Did your father manage to make a go of this farming?
Well, he didn't. I think he was awfully unlucky, because it was right up on the slopes of Mount Elgon, which was completely undeveloped country. And he had been told that there was going to be a railway running through there, and the very vast crops that he ultimately produced, some of them twice in a year, grain, coffee, maize, and also, of course, the big timber concession with marvellous teak up in the forests of Mount Elgon, he couldn't move them, really, to sell them. And so, after waiting for them, railway to materialise rather too long, he had to pack it up.
You resumed your education in America. Did you find the educational system very different over there?
Well, I was at great disadvantage, because having spent nearly a year with a tutor who taught me nothing at all except to read humorous classics, I think they have just about all, absolutely no mathematics, and I don't think he knew any. I went to school in America and immediately found myself very much behind in mathematics, geometry, algebra, and so on. That really was my biggest difficulty.
You went on to the Massachusetts Institute of Technology.
Well, after the prep school, I went to Andover, which is a public school. The two great ones are Andover and Exeter, strange to say, with English names. And after that, I went on to the Massachusetts Institute of Technology for a year. I didn't study chemical engineering, but I didn't stay there because my parents came back from East Africa then, and my two brothers were in England as well. And so I thought I'd join the whole family back in England.
Did you find any of the chemical engineering you did there relevant at all later when you went?
Oh, I think very much so, because the year that I spent at the Massachusetts Institute of Technology, or slightly less, one learned basic physics and chemistry and maths, which later came in very valuably to me indeed.
Round about what date was it, actually, that you returned to England? Sometime in the 20s?
Late, 1926.
At that stage, one might say that your formative years had been rather unsettled, to say the least. Did you at that stage have any ideas about settling down to a career?
Well, no. And this is really, I suppose, the difficulty for many young chaps. I had no idea what I wanted to be. When I had gone to study chemical engineering at the Massachusetts Institute of Technology, the other chaps who really had an aim in view, their prospects were going as research chemists or something of that sort to, say, canning factories like Campbell Soups and working on metals that wouldn't corrode with various types of ingredients. Well, now that really didn't ultimately interest me at all. And when I got back to England, things were pretty depressed one way or another. It was just after the general strike, I think of 1926, if I remember rightly. And everything was pretty depressed. It was difficult to get a job, and I did a few odd things, one way or another, but nothing that contributed to an ultimate career at all. And it wasn't until late 1928 that, wondering what on earth I should begin to do seriously in life, that I heard on the radio one night that the government were offering short service commissions in the Royal Air Force for people to learn to fly and to serve for, I think it was 4 years. And then after that I thought, at least I will have had a jolly good time and done what I'd always been interested in, that is flying.
You had, in fact, at that stage, you had actually been up in an aeroplane at Croydon.
Well, I had, a very modest affair, a 5-shilling flight at Croydon, I think about 6 months to a year before that, in, I think it was an Avro with a Clerget rotary engine, probably one of the last ever to be used, as far as I know, in actual flying. And I can't say that that fired my imagination. It was merely a continuous experience, really, from my model aeroplane days to actually getting in a full-size one.
Had you kept your model aeroplanes, or had they been all just...
Oh, no. Model aeroplanes never lasted long, for obvious reasons. You only got to fly them off in a too great a wind or some maladjustment on them, and that crashed them. And since they were bought ones, and I didn't at that time make my own, which I did subsequently, they didn't last long, and I didn't keep them. No, I'm afraid, at that sort of age, one didn't keep anything.
Did you launch them like paper darts, did you?
Oh, no. They were mostly elastic-powered, but one of the most interesting ones I had came from this German shop, Lorberg's, in the High Street, Kensington, and it had a compressed air engine, and you pumped up a long aluminium cylinder with a bicycle pump, and then switched it on, and the air released from it passed through 3 aluminium cylinders which rotated the propeller. Well, this was a marvellous thing as an engineering toy, but it wasn't very good flying because it was too heavy for the wings that supported it.
Was that expensive?
Yeah, well, in those days, yes, very.
So basically, what was it that attracted you to the idea of a short service commission?
Well, I thought that flying is something that I'd always been interested in, although I'd never really consciously contemplated doing it. Then there was another aspect. First of all, I got nothing to do, and I thought it would be awfully interesting to go into one of the services, and especially to learn to fly for free, have a jolly good time for 4 years. I'm afraid rather put off the great decision what you're going to do ultimately, but I don't know whether it was common to my generation, but certainly I didn't, and I don't think many of my friends had long-term plans for their careers in their late teens or very early 20s.
How did your friends and family react to this decision? Did any of them follow you?
No, nobody. Oh, no, certainly not follow me, because after all, the Air Force was very small and not a lot of people went into it anyway. I think that the Air Force was not regarded, certainly, as the smartest service at that time to go into, because it had rather a wild reputation from the very dashing chaps of the RFC at the end of the, well, during the end of the war, whose life was a very short and often very gay one. And I think that in a way, anybody who wanted a bit of prestige going into the services went into probably, say, the Rifle Brigade or the Guards or something like that. But that really wasn't open to me, nor did I ever want to become a soldier.
Did your family approve of the decision?
Well, my mother and father had separated at that time, and I think that their concerns were rather introspective than about my own future. That was one of the reasons, really, that I had nothing particular to do, because my parents had separated, and I had very little guidance in a career in life.
Had your brothers found careers by that stage?
Yes, they had. My younger brother was most fortunately put into the British American Tobacco Company right at the bottom, and ultimately made his way up quite high in it. Spent most of his time in China, in fact. My elder brother had always been keen about motor cars, and he'd been with Rolls-Royce for a short time in America, and then he came back to England and was with Rolls. Then he went with H.M. Bentley, who sold Bentleys in Hanover Street in London, and that was what he did up until the beginning of the Second World War.
You mentioned just now that the RAF had a rather wild reputation. What were the different aspects of that reputation? You mentioned financial dealings.
Well, yes. This is really looking back and making deductions as to why it was so. I think it was certainly a hangover from the end of World War I, when the RFC casualties were very great, and the pilots reckoned their life was going to be a short, and they wanted it to be a merry one, and so they probably were a bit wilder than most, and this, I think, showed itself to some extent in the running into debt and that sort of thing, which by the time I came into the Air Force, which was 12 years after the end of World War I, the Air Ministry were determined to stop in the biggest possible way, and it was a court-martial offence to issue a dud cheque. And this really was most frightening to most of us, because we lived on very little when we first went in. Indeed, most of the time, lived on very little. And it really was quite frightening. And there were a number of courts-martial from people who weren't careful about issuing checks. And I think this really came from the rather gay boys and gallant, immensely gallant chaps of the RFC, who perhaps weren't as careful as they might be in their dealings in civil life.
When you, in fact, joined up in 1929, to what extent did you find personally that this reputation was still justified then?
I don't think it was justified, because the Air Ministry, then I don't think it was, the Air Ministry had really tightened up discipline Very much indeed. On the other hand, you couldn't change the sort of characteristics of almost gay abandon of the young flying man. Whether this was a tradition that came to us from the Royal Flying Corps and was still in evidence, or what, I really don't know. But there's no doubt about it that certainly in my time there were far more characters, eccentrics indeed, amongst the pilots, certainly in my fighter squadron, than I've ever seen since in a long career in the Air Force. And I think the reason for this is partly the tradition of the RFC, but I think also partly the fact that you weren't practically allowed to marry till you were 30 years old. Marriage was not... you couldn't get marriage allowance until you were 30, and my word, you couldn't, unless you had some private means, marry and live on a single officer's pay. So that I think that made everybody, rather just have a jolly good time and not worry too much about saving money for the future. Well, you couldn't anyway.
Can you think of any particular eccentricities that any of these characters say in your fighter squadron, which we'll come on to talk about in a minute, any eccentricities that particular ones have?
Well, not so much as what they did as their general character. I think that there were a few there who were pretty free with the bottle, but not, of course, during flying. That was a court-martial offence. But in the evenings, the mess, it was pretty bright at times. And you see, the officers were made up of three rather different types. First of all, you had the permanent professional officer who came from Cranwell. And he was obviously the most level-headed, a man who was looking forward to the future, and a much steadier kind. Then you had chaps like me, who were short service, who were about a third of the total, or perhaps more. And they largely came in, as I did, knowing not what else to do, and came in for a good time and were keen about flying, but also keen about really having a good time almost more than anything else. And it was said of us that the best officers in the Air Force and the worst, and probably more of the latter, were to be found in the short service officers. The third group were the residue of the old RFC officers. Now, I say old because the ones I saw obviously had been passed over for promotion, but the others were all our senior officers were either ex-RNS or RFC. So this residue of still junior officers, with some with grey hairs, they knew they had no future. They're just serving out their time. They also carried with them their very gay attitude to a many life, if a short one. And some of them certainly were a set of rather bad example fun at mess guest nights, I think. They were rather used to beating it up.
What sort of things went on?
They used to get going. I forgot what the game was called. Oh, yes, one of them was called High Cockalorum. Somebody stood or was bent, partially bent against the wall with his face towards the wall, and then other people, one after the other, would jump onto his back and to see how many could finally get up before the lot collapsed. Well, of course, this very often broke some bones. And then there was another one where they'd set up the furniture around the mess and everybody would be leapfrogging over it. Well, this, of course, was quite expensive on expensive uniforms, because in those days we had to wear mess kit a great deal of the time, and if you tore that up, you had to have it either repaired or replaced, which cost a great deal, which we couldn't afford. So I can't tell you any particular eccentric person. I can tell you one that who was world famous at the time, who was in the other squadron, and that was Dick Atchley. He was a great eccentric, really, both in flying and in his general life, really. He certainly didn't drink at all, but he was a marvellous pilot, and he more or less invented crazy flying. He'd get hold of an old Avro and waggle it off the ground in the most terrifying manner, almost stalled into the air, of course under complete control. This in itself was pretty eccentric. I should also mention here that he'd come to Kenley, where I was, from the Schneider Cup of the, I think, a year before.
When you decided to take your short service commission then, what kinds of tests did you have to take?
Well, of course, before anything at all, you had a medical test to see that your eyes and your physique were acceptable. And also some test of education or proof.